man is your land. This man is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this man was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, Lend-Lease, episode 21. We're recording this on January 26, 2020. This is our last podcast episode from the Arsenal for Democracy Lend-Lease series. We will be resuming at long last the Arsenal for Democracy radio show on the air from WVUD next week, according to our current schedule. I'm probably going to call that one episode 294, which means we're jumping up in the numbers according to, you know, account for the numbers that we were numbering under Lend-Lease, but it's all part of the same broader umbrella. We were just doing a specific, more focused podcast of varying format and topic areas last summer and then this winter. Before we get into our topic of the week, I just wanted to very briefly mention something which I had meant to mention earlier in the Lend-Lease series this month in January of 2020, but I forgot about it until now. I was like flipping through looking to see like, oh, what happened in the year 1920, you know, 100 years ago, because of course we were doing a lot of episodes that had to do with that general time period. And there was something specifically interesting that I thought we could mention. This was in New York State. So we've talked about the first Red Scare right after World War I. You had all these crackdowns on various anarchist groups and socialists and so forth. Anyway, so the Department of Justice had done Palmer raids, arresting 2,000 alleged leftists around the country and especially in New York. And the New York State Assembly Republican majority in January 1920, 100 years ago, decided to suspend 5 Socialist Party members before they could take their seats. They were eventually expelled in April of 1920. Special elections were called and held in September 1920 and resulted in the re-election of all 5 Socialist Party members who had been expelled. 3 of them were subsequently expelled again, and the other 2 resigned in solidarity. So that was just an interesting thing that I thought we would mention as we close out our Arsenal for Democracy Lend-Lease podcast, which we have spent a lot of time talking about that time period 100 years ago. So it was an interesting thing to note. But we are now going to be spending the rest of the episode talking about something very current, which has been unfolding specifically over the last basically half of a year, but obviously has longer roots, as all these things that we talk about do. So we're going to be talking about the situation in India at the moment, the political situation there. One of the reasons that we were had put this on our radar to talk about before we wrap up the podcast is the fact that Nate was out and about walking around in Harvard Square in Cambridge and saw some demonstrations related to some of the stuff we're going to be talking about. So we've got this week me, your host Bill Humphrey. We've got Rachel in Idaho. We've got Nate on the line in Cambridge, ready to talk about this India topic in some great depth. And Rachel and I will be chiming in on various specific points. Nate, let's start with that initial demonstration that you saw by these, expatriate Indian citizens in Harvard Square. You were initially not even sure what they were, which side they were on, and what was the case they were making.
Well, yeah, I mean, that location near former Out of Town News, RIP, in Harvard Square, sort of a popular protest spot because, you know, just high traffic, you know, a lot of people seeing you. I've seen, like, Falun Gong protesters there telling me about the Chinese organ trade and, you know, whatnot. There might have been some Hong Kong people there recently. So any sort of, like, big protest movement around the world, especially at a place where, you know, lots of people from all over the world come together, there's typically a lot of protests. So, yeah, as I was saying, there I saw a bunch of people, you know, handmade signs. But then, like, this issue is a little confusing because there's a lot of, like, acronyms involved. And then you just sort of see, like, CAA, NCR, you know, like all these. And then, of course, like the NRI, non-resident Indian, I believe. So just like an expatriate, I guess, is the term for that. But basically, he was saying, yeah, we support these. And then the language they were using was sort of, it was framing it as like, oh, this is protecting minorities. So then, like, that sort of leads to a little bit of confusion, or they're sort of trying to present it in a, the most plausible light for them. And that, of course, we'll get into it. But part of the Citizenship Amendment Act would allow various religious minorities from other countries who had been living in India before a cutoff date would give them pass to citizenship, but not for Muslims. So Parsis, Jain, Christian, these are the religious minorities that were being not targeted, but allowed in. But yeah, the big sticking point is the exclusion of Muslims from this act. So anyway, I yelled some stuff about Modi at them, and then you know, headed away. I had to check first to see what exactly they were protesting for before I just, like, you know, spouted off. But felt like, you know, it was justified. But anyway, but we'll also talk about, there's been a lot of protests in opposition to this act as well amongst South Asian Americans. So it sort of is a spot of consultation and debate. And we'll also maybe get into an article that's sort of like comparing a situation, like talking to your family about the issue, you know, comparing it to sort of the classic talking to the Trump supporters at the Thanksgiving dinner table or whatever. So we'll get a bit into that, I guess.
Where do we go from here on this topic? There's obviously been a lot of upheaval and protests in India itself, not just over on this side of the world. What's been happening with this? I mean, what's the context for this, first of all? Because I don't know if people are necessarily familiar. I feel like one of the big themes that's come up is how much whitewashing has gone into the Western media coverage of Modi's government as a whole.
Howdy, Modi.
I mean, this is a guy who we talked about a number of years back on Arsenal for Democracy, I think, about the fact that he used to be banned by the State Department from even coming to the United States because of his role in fomenting acts of genocide when he was governor of the state of Gujarat.
Bill, right here, from a Washington Post article entitled India's Iconic Democracy Feels Like It's Under Siege, written by a white person, of course, you know, but sort of her travelogue. But in basically, the prime minister is now Narendra Modi, a religious hardliner who was once accused of abetting the anti-Muslim rioters in Gujarat as the state's chief minister, which, you know, is a that's a nice way of putting it. You know, so it, this is all very there. Yeah. And then we were talking about the Howdy Modi thing a little earlier. I think it was once past summer. Modi came to Houston, was it?
Yeah, I think so. Our friend of the show, Chris Hooks, was there to cover that event, I think. Right. So it was interesting to hear about that from that, you know, on the ground there in Texas. I mean, that's the thing, right? It's this full court press to get the whole, like, diaspora community. I mean, not the whole. I'm giving the perspective of the BJP here, not saying this is literally the whole diaspora is on board, but right, they're trying to rally as many people as possible to, like, back them up on this and create a pressure group in countries like the United States or probably Britain or wherever, Canada, I assume, too, to try to say, like, you know, no, this is this, like, really, you know, modern, forward-thinking, you know, economically liberalizing leader or whatever, and, which that isn't even really accurate itself, but because the economy's not doing that great now. But, yeah, basically just to cover up all of this.
Right, yeah. And so this article sort of describes this kind of descent into craziness ever since Modi's election. And of course, there's the issue of Kashmir. We'll get into it. In August, Modi's government abruptly revoked the semi-autonomous rights for Kashmir that India's constitution had granted them in 1950, then flooded the region with troops, cut off the internet, and banned news coverage for several months. And there's been some reporting trips in there describing the climate of fear and repression.
Do we want to go to Rachel on that?
Yeah, just quickly. This article also says, and we'll get into this more, but authorities have used force, legal measures, and harsh rhetoric to intimidate Muslims, branding them as potential terrorists. Police have stood by as mobs have lynched Muslims for selling cows, which are venerated, of course, in Hinduism. And then it goes into the law. But the article sort of ends on a sort of hopeful note by noting all of the protests and saying that, you know, this demonstrates that despite repression, and you know, crackdown on democracy. It also shows that people are also very you know, willing to protest and willing to engage in the democratic process. So there's still, it's still a state of struggle there. So, but yeah, we should talk about Kashmir.
All right. So Rachel, you're going to talk about what's going on in the disputed territory between the Indian zone of the disputed territory between India, Pakistan, and to a lesser extent, China.
Right. So back in August, the Indian government revoked Article 370, which gave the state of Jammu and Kashmir a special status. Just kind of, they were autonomous. They were allowed to kind of rule over themselves. And then with this revoking of this Article 370, Kashmir actually became a union territory rather than a state of India, which is unprecedented. This has never happened before. Soon after that, Kashmir has been placed under curfew. There are internet and cell service blackouts. Actually, I think it's still going on. The internet blackout is still going on.
They just started rolling it back a little bit this actual weekend when we're recording this, but we'll talk about that later.
Okay. Good timing then that we're talking about it. And actually, Indian officials, the external affairs minister, canceled a meeting with senior members of the U.S. Congress this week because they, the Congress people refused to exclude Pramila Jayapal, from the representative from Washington, because she is sponsoring a resolution urging India to lift communications restrictions, restore the internet, and preserve religious freedom. They refused to disinvite her, and so the Indians pulled out of this meeting.
She is herself born in Chennai in India, just for people who don't know.
Yeah. This Washington Post article that I'm pulling this story from was published in December 19th, and at that point, the internet shutdown had entered its 134th day, making it the longest shutdown of its kind imposed on a democracy, according to internet advocacy group Access Now. Modi's government has defended these restrictions on security grounds, but it's just really apparent that they're oppressing the Muslim-majority state of Kashmir.
The internet blackout point, I think, is a key one here. As I said, they have partially started relaxing it, but only kind of nominally at the time that we're recording this. So this is kind of, you know, hot off the presses yesterday and today. But, you know, so the BJP ruling party in India is, virulently Hindu nationalist. And, you know, you can look through history, has ties to various far right global tendencies and, you know, and fascism, essentially. A lot of us are comfortable with calling the BJP fascist party. Some people are not. I would argue that the people who are not are basically the whitewashing Western media
RSS
forces and so forth. But
So
the RSS, which, you know, again, you can go look up additional details on this. But yes, they were very inspired by the Nazis and Hitler. And this is a continuous through line, I guess, to the present day. And again, the incidents from Gujarat in the early 2000s. Again, the George W. Bush administration State Department was the one that banned Modi from coming to the United States because he was too hard on the Muslims. So just to give people an indication, and again, then people will say, well, but how could he be a fascist, right? Because he's democratically elected by these huge majorities. It's like, okay, I mean, that's not great, but that doesn't mean he's not a fascist because the internet blackouts are sort of the most, I think, obvious, besides the just actual full-blown lynch mobs running around, which Nate alluded to earlier. From a state power perspective, any time that there is any dissent on anything toward this government, the Modi government, basically their first thing they do is press the button to turn off the internet. I mean, it's not a literal button, but like they call up the telecoms companies. Yeah. And they say, you know, shut down the tubes, right? Like,
was it 134 shutdowns?
Yeah. There were 134 internet shutdowns in 2019 alone in India. And we looked at a BBC article as well. And I was kind of shocked to see this graph. Like, a few years back, it would be, you know, a relatively low number of internet shutdowns per year. And then they kept creeping up and creeping up and creeping up. And pretty soon you get to this point where you have 134 shutdowns in 2019 alone. And again, let's talk about the scale that we're discussing here when we describe these internet shutdowns. This is not a temporary one-night thing. This is not a small contained area. This is not, you know, partial shutdown or just blocking certain sites, as we see in, you know, some other countries when there's protests and demonstrations. We're talking about in Kashmir that they cut off the internet for 8 million people for half a year, and the partial access that they've restored this weekend is to 301 approved websites. And if you're accessing it via mobile internet, which of course many people in developing nations go on the internet on their phone and not through, you know, hardline connections or Wi-Fi or whatever, those are at 2G level speeds. So they have, the companies are throttling the speeds to 2G level access, which, as one person quoted in the New York Times said, that's basically not enough to even be able to check your email in many cases, because, of course, most email providers are not, you know, they don't have dial-up speeds in mind anymore for their user interface and everything. So it's kind of a joke that they've restored the internet. Earlier this year, the entire state of Uttar Pradesh got their internet cut off. Again, the government just cites a public order law that's on the books and then tells the telecoms to shut off the internet. Uttar Pradesh has 200 million people living in it. That is greater than the population of Nigeria. It is almost as large as the population of Brazil. It is almost as large as the population of Pakistan. That is one state, 200 million people, and they just turned off the internet because they didn't want these protests to happen. And that's what they're directly responding to. In Kashmir, they did it preemptively. Before they moved the troops in, they were like, well, there's going to be people mad about this, so let's cut off their ability to organize and communicate with the outside world about what's happening here. Cha-ching, boom, no more internet. But again, Uttar Pradesh, we're talking about 200 million people. Similarly, we saw protests in Assam. There were various things. A lot of them were protesting against the citizenship law because there's large Muslim populations there or various other populations of minority groups that could potentially be affected. And they just flip the switch, cut off the internet there. This has become their go-to tool to just suppress anything like this. And for all the criticism that gets, you know, made of the great firewall of China and the government there, you know, they're very undemocratic. I mean, we're not even going to get into the viral stuff that's happening right there now. But anyway, just that, like, that versus the coverage of this, which is, like, very minimal. I mean, obviously, yeah, we're citing articles here, so it's not like it's totally not being covered. We'll get into later some lack of coverage problems on some of this, but it's not like people are not really grasping the severity of the situation. And like, India is often referred to, oh, it's the world's largest democracy because it's got, you know, more than a billion people in it, is nominally a democracy, and there's many aspects of it that continue to have the trappings of democracy, but that doesn't really mean that it's fundamentally a very stable and secure democracy. And you need to only go back to the emergency period in India, and that's a specific time period as an 18-month period from 1975 to 1977. That was when Indira Gandhi was in power, one of the times that I should say that she was in power. And that's something that is very much on the mind of a lot of people of a certain generation. I think people in Pramila Jayapal's generation, for example, are specifically very kind of keyed in on that particular point. This is not a continuous, stable, pluralistic, amazing, functional democracy that has continued since independence in the 1940s. This is a democracy that has a lot of fragility underlying it. And obviously, as you know, Nate mentioned the Washington Post article saying, oh, it's a hopeful sign that you have these protests happening. I don't want to downplay that at all, right? We're going to talk in a bit later on in the episode about the general strikes in response to the government, right? There are reasons to be very encouraged by the level of sort of civil society opposition being exercised to some of this. But by the same token, we have a majoritarian fascist government that is absolutely committed to religious supremacy over a very significant minority population in their country, And they are willing to just cut off people's rights at the drop of a hat and block them from organizing and rallying to do protests to achieve their political goals. So I just want to kind of underscore that. Now, can you talk a little bit more in detail about the Kashmir occupation and kind of that context?
Yeah. So in talking about all the treatment of the Muslim minority in India, Kashmir is historically a Muslim majority state, which has kind of led to it's kind of been seen as a quote Muslim majority state with special privileges because they have had this autonomy. So that kind of flies in the face of the BJP as a Hindu nationalist party. They view India as fundamentally Hindu rather than the secular republic envisioned by its founders. So that's kind of some of the historical context on why Kashmir in particular is being targeted. Also, Ladakh, a mountainous and predominantly Buddhist area of Jammu and Kashmir, has been separated and kind of turned into a separate territory. So it's kind of scary to see that India and the Hindu Nationalist Party is kind of splitting off and isolating these minority territories and taking away their power. This is coming from a Washington Post article from August, kind of talking about the revoking of Article 370.
Yeah, I mean, part of the challenge here is the changing demographics in India poses a significant... It doesn't pose a real threat, but if you are coming from this fascist Hindu supremacy background, it poses a threat to you, essentially. As you alluded to, right, the foundation of the republic was that despite the partition conducted by the British into, you know, Pakistan and Bangladesh and so forth, and then India itself... the idea that, you know, people like, say, Gandhi had was, no, there should be unity. It's not as simple as just drawing lines on a map. There's mixed communities everywhere. This should be this secular, multicultural, pluralist community. And of course, by its nature, setting aside the religious aspect, India has to be pluralistic just because of the sheer number of different ethnicities and languages spoken, etc. So on some level, they have to retain pluralism. The question then becomes, does that extend as far as religious views? And of course, as we said, you know, the RSS groups, the BJP groups, they do not agree with that premise, right? Their view is that the significant population, forced population transfers under threat of significant communal violence of Muslims and Hindus crossing the various borders during the partition, that that was a good thing that was necessary to the, you know, stability and security of the state and everything. Again, just total, absolute nonsense fascism, but that's the view that they're putting forth. But for a long time, of course, you had just overwhelming, you know, numbers of Hindus as a result of that significant purge of forcing Muslims out of the country at the beginning. And you had these certain areas where there were significant Muslim populations, but overall, it wasn't really in dispute what the predominant religion was. And of course, it still isn't, right? Because it's 79% Hindu at this point. But that number is down from what it historically had been in the past or so, right? We've had, you know, significant percentage increase, a significant increase in the percentage points that are Muslim. And that is terrifying to them, especially if you break down the, you know, numbers of actual millions of people in some of the recent censuses.
Even though Muslims are a religious minority, there are 200 million Muslims in India, so a significant number.
At that point, you're starting to get into the territory of, oh, the same number of Muslims living in India as the actual population of Pakistan itself, which then again leads you to the question of like, hey, maybe they shouldn't have partitioned the country in the first place. Way to go, Britain. And if you are a fascist who believes in the total supremacy of Hinduism over Islam and doesn't want to have this, you know, these minority protections, this is a nip it in the bud situation where this is the last moment where they might be able to clamp down on this. Again, as we said, there's lots of examples of people who are not themselves Muslim protesting against this and acting in solidarity to say this is unacceptable, these crackdowns. But that's kind of the rationale for all of this happening at once. They are seizing the moment before, in their minds, it will be too late to do anything about it.
To go back to not listing Myanmar in their list of refugee status countries, I read somewhere, I'm not entirely sure where, that India is also kind of fast tracking deportations of Rohingya minorities in India, seeking refuge at the, from the genocide. So it's really kind of scary to see that happening right now.
I guess we'll go back to you now, Nate, to keep going on the narrative here.
All right. So do you want to talk about the size of the protest or sort of give some more background onto the actual law?
Maybe talk about the law a little bit more.
Right. So there will be an exception for members of six religious minority communities, Hindu, Sikh, Buddhist, Jain, Parsi, and Christian, if they can prove they are from Pakistan, Afghanistan, or from Bangladesh. They have to live or work in India for 6 years to be eligible for citizenship by naturalization. And then there's been some discussion of specifically which countries are included, like the inclusion of Afghanistan is estranged there. And then was not include Myanmar because basically the fear there would be you'd have a large, like there would be a lot of refuge then given to religious minority, Rohingya minorities, because of course there's the large
crisis.
Yeah, exactly. So lots of refugees there. So basically it was sort of pick to choose. But there's a long article in India Telegraph basically saying NRC and the citizenship bill are the greatest threat to Indian democracy. And so reading from a bit here, a normalization of mob violence against minorities can only be a preliminary to the real substance of a Hindu Rashtra, namely the legitimization of formal discrimination against them. And the agenda of Modi's second term is institutionalization of discrimination. Central to the project is the goal, beloved of all committed majoritarian leaders, from Erdogan to Orban, of reducing minorities to second-class citizenship. Informally secular constitutional democracies like India, this is a complicated business because sometimes you need special majorities in parliament and the acquiescence of the Supreme Court in what would be a flagrant violation of the structure of the constitution. So then it goes into we're giving these persecuted religious minorities, oh, but because these are Muslim countries, then they can't claim to be persecuted religious minorities. And then the main purpose of the citizenship bill is the delegitimization of Muslim citizenship. And then it goes on to explain, Myanmar. And then it talks a little about the NRC process, and that's a little bit different because that's, I think, currently only in the Assam state, I believe. But it's sort of registration, and basically the processes have so far yielded 4 million residents who are deemed not to be citizens. So far, a substantial of this number are non-Muslims, but were the CAB or CAA, as it's also called, to be passed, then these non-Muslims illegals would cease to be concerned to Indian authorities because it would basically get amnesty from the law. So if you sort of combine these two, that's sort of the process of why it would be, okay, we're going to get rid of Muslim citizens that way, or deny them the process of becoming citizens. So continuing from the article, if the CAB becomes the law of the land, the immigration authorities, the police, and every government institution will be legally justified in focusing on asking Muslims and only Muslims to prove they are true citizens. Muslims as a class could then be legitimately profiled because the law of the land requires them to be. And then it goes into, okay, will it pass judicial muster? What happens when the NRC covers all of India? And then it would empower potentially vigilantes or busybodies to determine whether all these Muslims true citizens, and basically force Muslims to prove themselves at all. And then this will be the institutional inauguration of a Hindu Rashtra, the firm foundation of an Indian fascism. So that's a very interesting long article that sort of goes into it with a lot more depth than, you know, you're getting necessarily in the Western press. So I think that's important to talk about. But we should probably talk about the actual protests and how they've been spreading.
Well, the big one that I wanted to highlight, especially because of what we've talked about all year long on the Arsenal for Democracy Lend-Lease podcast episodes, has been the general strike response. So obviously there have been other protests as well. That's part of why the internet blackouts aforementioned have been happening to try to prevent those. But in terms of the most sort of organized demonstrated public opposition, we saw on January 8th a general strike against the Modi government, and they basically pulled in as many possible threads as they could think of for why they were rallying, right? So they were against the CAA bill for its discrimination. They were against the poor economic performance of the government, the rising unemployment. They were against the various other abuses of power, etc. There was a CNN article that notes that, you know, the unemployment was up 7.6%, up to 7.6%, up from 6.9% the previous year, and that the growth forecast had been reduced to 5% growth per year. Of course, we saw in China not too long ago that there started being some unrest and so forth as double-digit growth rates started slowing down toward, you know, single digits. Even if this would be hugely impressive growth in, say, the United States or something, for a country the size of India with the population that needs to find work, slowing down growth even to 5% can be a, you know, major cause of unrest and so forth. Anyway, now CNN, troublingly, referred to the general strike on January 8th as thousands of workers linked to national trade unions took part in strikes across the country in protest against privatization and the impact of the economic slowdown on jobs. Now, I found that it was surprisingly hard to find articles in Western sources that weren't socialist or communist sources talking about the general strikes, but there were plenty of articles in Indian publications, in Pakistani publications, etc., talking about this. And there were two that were particularly interesting. I found an article from a newspaper, and these are all going to be linked in the PDF that we release on arsenalfordemocracy.com with this episode. An article from a newspaper in Kerala. That's an Indian state that we've talked about previously. We did a whole episode talking about their focus on various housing, social housing programs and things like that. That is a state that has been dominated for decades by democratically elected communists and powerful trade unions. It's a very left-wing state politically. The article there said that there were more than 10 trade unions. It was 10 national trade unions or local or state trade unions combined with various other looser affiliations and federations of labor and so forth. They came together in September. Remember, this was right after the August occupation of Kashmir. They came together in September and they voted that in January of 2020, they would have a general strike nationwide. Now, this is not the first time that India has had general strikes, certainly. There was a general strike in 2016, 150 million, 180 million were the ranges on that 24-hour general strike against Modi's previous plans for privatization. And again, we had the 10 trade unions participating. This one was an estimated up to 250 million workers came out into the streets as part of a brief nationwide general strike to demonstrate against the Modi government. Pakistani newspaper freelance columnist that I found noted that literally more people participated in the general strike than the number of people who voted for the BJP government, if those figures are correct. 229 million voters for the BJP versus 250 million strikers potentially. Another article, that same column said the January 8th strike was one of the greatest shows of strength, power, and solidarity by Indian workers. The 24-hour strike shut down banking, transport, retail, public services, construction, and industry in many parts of the country. Workers blocked highways and railroad tracks with their bodies, barricades, and burning tires. Now, again, there was some coverage of it in Western media, but it was so laughably minimal. Again, to reiterate, the CNN article talking about a general strike of up to 250 million people referred to it as thousands of workers from the trade unions took part in strikes. They are operating in India on a whole other level than we are. So again, there is some cause for optimism in the sense that we still have very significantly organized public opposition demonstrations to this government. So not all hope is lost, but that is only because of the might and power and solidarity of these very powerful trade unions, which is not something that it necessarily exists in a lot of other countries. And that's something that we've been talking about all year long on the Arsenal for Democracy Lend-Lease podcast, is the need for these very powerful independent trade unions that can come out and just shut down, you know, industry and sector after sector after sector to grind everything to a halt.
I think another protest worth mentioning is the massive human chain formed in Kerala, which we've talked about before, or we've talked about Kerala before, but the Left Democratic Front, led by Communist Party of India, Marxist, created a, because for the 71st Republic Day, where the Constitution was adopted, I guess the Constitution was read out loud, in sort of a celebration, but there was a 620-kilometer-long human chain stretching thing from a couple different cities, and you had the chief minister come out, basically, and he said, peaceful protests are possible when the entire population unites. We can take pride in this fact. The participation of the human chain has been overwhelming. The message is clear. We do not accept CAA as this divides people on the basis of religion. Nations across the world and the United Nations should not have let this happen. And in Kerala, we have already made it clear that neither NPR nor NRC will happen. We will not rest until CAA is withdrawn. So it sounds like there was even like a newly wedded couple that was involved in this. They were like, oh, I don't really know much about what's going on, but we wish them all the success for the human chain. So that's a little bit of flavor there. But I think also worth mentioning, there have been protests as well in the United States against the CAA. And I guess for I think it was maybe last Sunday, was designated as a National Day of Action. I saw some pictures on Twitter of South Asians marching, I think in New York, but I'm not positive where it was, but it might have been a couple different places. But it seems like there have been several South Asian civil society groups in America, including South Asians Leading Together, have talked about this and gave some quotes to NBC News, basically saying they were critical of the Howdy Modi event. Felt that it was sort of a celebration for Trump as well. This is interesting. And we also mentioned Pramila Jayapal was involved, Ro Khanna, represented from California, and just a lot of different groups coming together, college students, and speaking out against this. So that's encouraging to see as well. Yeah, there were protests in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Seattle, Washington. So it seems like this, you know, this is really something that's becoming more and more prominent. And, you know, both sides are seemingly out in protest about it.
Now, before we get to Rachel again, do you want to talk about the university protests at all, Nate?
Oh, yeah. So this actually was in December, I believe. Yeah, December 15th. Jamila Islamia, a historically Muslim university. There were the police basically attacked them. I just watched a video where they're like beating people with sticks, and you had this viral sort of video went around of a Muslim woman sort of protecting the person who was being beaten up, and she was like shaking her finger at them. And there have been lots of there's a highway. One specifically, which has been shut down by a large protest, mostly of Muslim women who are, opposed to this law. And so there have been these types of sort of direct action protests.
Rachel, do you want to talk at all about thoughts on any of the protests or the general strike?
I did want to mention also in the Al Jazeera article talking about Republic Day, the Indian president hosted Jair Bolsonaro at a big event in the capital of India. So just kind of pointing out that right-wing autocrats of a feather stick together. So the company that they are courting is also very authoritarian, very dangerous.
Nate, you want to wrap this up for us?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the actual prospects are of the court overruling these laws or, you know, whether it's the protests are going to be enough to prevent them from coming to pass. But it does seem like this is going to be an issue that we're going to have to continue to keep an eye on, because it doesn't seem like it's going away anytime soon. So that would sort of be my thoughts on all this. And, you know, it's good to see the protests both here and in India. So,
Rachel, your sort of summary thoughts on all of this?
I think it's encouraging to see that non-Muslims are mobilizing and turning out to protest in solidarity for these Muslims. I think it's encouraging, it's really good to see this show of solidarity, and just people coming together in huge numbers is what gets stuff done. So hopefully these protests and strikes have been effective and will kind of slow the spread of fascism in India.
Yes, I think my key takeaways are: one, the BJP and Prime Minister Modi are fascist. Two, the strongest counterbalance to fascism is an empowered leftist activist trade union movement. And three, it took them from September to January to organize a general strike nationwide for a 24-hour period. So maybe some American leftists can cool it a little bit with their general strike talk if they're not willing to put in the months and months of preparation on top of the fact that we don't have a strong trade union movement. But it shows you what you can do if you do build a strong trade union movement. And I think that on an upcoming episode of Arsenal for Democracy, the radio show, which we expect will be returning next week in its half-hour format that does not deviate from the half-hour format, but also still available online and in the usual locations. You don't need to update your feed or anything. We'll probably be talking about the French strikes that have been unfolding recently. And of course, as we talked about on an earlier episode of Arsenal for Democracy, Lend-Lease, France is the birthplace of the empowered, autonomous, left-wing syndicalist trade union movements, which inspired that in most of the rest of the world. That's the core of the sort of all of the theories that developed out of specific practices in pre-World War I France. So there you have it, folks. Nate, thank you for putting this topic on the docket for us to go over and for doing the bulk of the research on this one.
Great to be here, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you for joining us, as always, from Idaho to talk about this as well.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Nate.
All right. That is it, folks, for Arsenal for Democracy, Lend-Lease, Episode 21, and the series as a whole. Maybe we'll be back someday. I don't know. As I said, you don't need to update your subscription feeds or anything. Arsenal for Democracy, the radio show in its tight and succinct format, will be back soon. We think next week from WVUD in Delaware, our parent station. And we look forward to having you. It happens that we're starting up right around the time that the actual presidential primaries, after our long Bataan death march to get here, are finally starting up. So you can guess that we are probably going to... we're going to still try to keep focusing on some of these bigger picture and historical things as much as possible, because people seem to really like that, and we're getting a lot out of it too, I think. But you can imagine that we will also be talking somewhat about some of the, you know, what's going on with the presidential race and so forth. Anyway, that's it. ArsenalForDemocracy.com to get all of the articles and many more that we referenced today. Thanks again for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.